I have the most janky, basic farm stand out on the road, and anything that's surplus of mine that I'm not going to eat or I'm not going to use, I put out there and it disappears. It goes away and people, you know, kick down, and it's great. And I don't have prices on anything. It's just so lovely to see people give for whatever.
I'm super stoked. Today, I've got for you an interview with Brandon Bredo, the farm manager of Hansel Vineyards. He manages all the animals. So they got ducks and chickens and sheep. I don't think they have goats. He has goats at his house, though, that he runs. Pigs. And so he's really just a wealth of information about how to manage animals, and he's been doing it for years on a small holding and on a large holding. And in this conversation, we go over the importance of community and self-reliance, how to use fire or how to use animals to mitigate fire, as well as the mechanical means to do that as well. And then we take an example homestead, like let's say you had a half an acre, and then how you would develop and create an animal system. And what's so great about what Brandon does and what they do at Hansel Vineyards is they really take a regenerative agriculture, a polyculture, a permaculture style approach to the way that they grow their grapes and manage their whole site. So he's a wealth of information. It was a really valuable conversation for me. I hope you find it equally valuable. I did do an on-site tour of the work that he does there, and I'll put a link in the description to the video that I did of that. And without further ado, Brandon Bredo. So Brandon, thank you for taking the time to talking with me today about all your experience as a farm and forest manager at Hansel Vineyards. We were talking a little bit beforehand about giving people tips, how to start with farm, using animals to benefit their farm and integrate in their farm and their forest. I guess it'd be pretty instructive just to maybe share with everyone, you know, how did you get into this? Like how did you, what evolved you into this animal forest farm manager life that you're in right now?
Sure. Well, initially it honestly probably began out of a sense of escapism, you know, much like yourself, came out of Los Angeles County, you know, growing up there, and wanting a bit of more space, a bit more breathing room per se. So I ended up moving to Northern California, right after high school, literally the day of high school graduation. And then from there, I pursued a career in, public land management in the form of being a park ranger. So, I got involved with natural resource management for 25 years or so, working for various agencies. I did somewhat of an early retirement from Sonoma County Regional Parks as a ranger. And, through that career, I found myself managing big pieces of land with a coalition of other people, local tribes, and also folks that run cattle, you know, private operators. After all, you know, you can only mow so much. And with the fear of fire and the lack of experience, contemporary at least, with fire management, it seems a lot of stuff needs to be grazed as opposed to mechanical mowing. So I ended up working on quite a bit of private public cooperation with folks that run cows on public park land, which was a challenge in that it was kind of a new thing for the agency, and also trying to keep those things open to the public, those trails and those accesses while you have these cattle operating. So there's all that, you know, with bikes and equestrians and hikers and all that. So for the most part, that was my focus. I was really interested in more than the public safety, more than the EMT services and law enforcement. I found myself really interested in the natural resource management side of being a ranger. And so with this new career of mine, I would say it's my retirement gig, working as a farm sports manager with Hanzel Vineyards and Farm. It's a 200-acre property, and there's lots to do there. There's only 46 acres under cultivation, and the rest of it, almost 150 acres, is mature native forest on hillsides. And it's gorgeous, and it's all been undermanaged per se. So, you know, fire was on the land back in the 1960s, and since then it's just been a mess of duff, thick and ready for the next intense burn. And as we, many of us know, 2017 is really what changed things for the understanding of fire and how things can get away and to be these mega intense burns. And so my job, in addition to working with a lot of grazing animals and greenhouses and gardens and vineyards, is to prepare for the next fire on the land. And I know it's inevitable, so I just want it to be less intense. So that's kind of leading up to today.
Right. So why don't we segue into fire management? So that is, it's a huge topic. And if you could, you know, get it, simplify it in a sort of a nobody left behind approach, like what are your basic three bullet points of like, I'm trying to do X, Y, and Z with the animals or without the animals or in combination with the animals when you're, you know, you're in a, what would you call it? An oak savanna? Is that?
Yeah, oak. And then higher elevations, it's conifers. So it's a mixed, it's mostly oak woodland, with a little bit of grassland interference.
So you're in this, oak woodland mixed environment, which is going to be really appropriate for a lot of people in a lot of different environments. How would you go about using the animals and using in combination with mechanical processes to mitigate the fire risk on your?
Yep, that's good. Good topic. I start with an inventory on my end. It's all about the priorities. So I break things down into zones. So naturally, we want to protect our structures, our human-made structures. On our 200 acres, we have lots of buildings. You know, some are very historic, built in the 1940s and 50s. And so that's I radiate from there. So if I could protect those first and foremost by reducing the fuel load around those properties, whether it's by mechanical chippers and chainsaws, dragging that fuel away from those structures, and then maintaining it, ongoing maintenance program with animals on the ground. And the way I've been doing that is with pigs. So my pigs, my team of pigs are outstanding maintenance workers, and they help me immensely. So the concern, I mentioned buildings, not just our own buildings, but we're on the boundary. We're on an urban interface. Our southern boundary, our downhill side, there's a whole big neighborhood down there. And so back in 2017, Cal Fire cut a big dozer fire line down there. And so since 2017, I've been charged with maintaining a fire break. And in this, and what I've wanted to avoid is having just an ugly erosive strip of land that we just keep bare for the sake of a fire break. So now we've gone in and we've planted an orchard along there. And in that orchard, food forest, I'm also running sheep down there as well. So I'm maintaining that as something aesthetic and providing food. And I'm sure the neighbors really appreciate that by looking onto something that's under cultivation rather than just bare mineral soil waiting for the next fire.
Yeah, that really makes me think about it. I'm sure you've thought about this too, of the permaculture idea of stacking functions of you're maintaining a fire barrier, you're creating food and aesthetic with the orchard, and that sounds great. Can you get just a little bit more granular about the, let's just start with the structures. So what, you know, so right now I'm looking out my window past my camera here. I'm looking at 20 feet. I'm looking at a little pine, and another 30 feet out that way, I'm looking at a madrone, and then I'm looking at an oak. What are you doing with the trees? Like how far away and how far up and what's on the ground and just a real basic, and then how would you use the pigs after you've got that in the way that you want it?
So on a textbook note, like if you're getting input from Cal Fire or other agencies that are charged with fire, they would say to clear a space, 100 feet plus around each structure, and think about if you had a canopy fire, no trees. Yeah. So it's about what I'm getting at. It's a balance of aesthetics and function and ecosystem services and fire protection. So there's got to be a compromise in there somewhere just because you live there and you want to function there in a place that's gorgeous. I mean, that's probably why you move there to begin with, is because it's because of the environment. So it's, if you think of a canopy or a crown fire and those trees coming down, would they land on your roof? Those are kind of concerns. I would thin as much as possible that you can tolerate, in and around your structure. And as you radiate further out is where you can allow that wildness to continue. But it's all about keeping a fire, when it does return, keeping it low intense and on the ground and away from those, that canopy. So if you could reduce the ladder fuel leading up to those canopies, then go for it with a pull saw.
Right. And even more granular, like how many feet up would you, do you think, like, it's obviously going to be different in every situation, but in general.
Yeah. It depends on what's growing on the on the floor of the forest. So if there are things that are annual, grasses and whatnot, that's a flashy fuel that's not going to take off into the canopy. I reach as high as I can with a pull saw. We have a lot of Doug firs that sort of reach down and sort of touch the ground in a way, unless I take that ladder fuel off. So once I do that, I feel a lot better. And I know the fire agencies in the neighborhood too, that inspect, feel better about that too. You're taking
and
that
pull saw is like 15 feet long.
Yeah, maybe 12. Yeah. 15. 12 if I'm standing on top of my, utility vehicle.
Can you send a picture of that shot?
Oh yeah. I specifically put a roof on my UTV made of 3/4-inch plywood so I could stand
really
on like a deck.
Yeah, you gotta send a picture of that one. That's great. Do you have one already on your Instagram? Like a picture of you on the
Maybe one of my coworkers. I might have gotten a shot with them doing that. Yeah, trying not to kill themselves. That back to the structure thing too. You know, what's the siding on your house? What's the roof on your house? All of that material matters when it comes to the choice on how far away to clear your defensible space.
It makes me also think about. I watched a video a while back of a fire test where they were like shooting a cannon of like flaming fireballs at the side of a house, and one house, and they're both of the houses were made out of the same thing, but one had just like gravel on the ground, and the other one had plant, just like whatever plants or wood chips around it. And the one with the gravel on the ground, even though they're both sort of wood siding, it was fine because the fireballs hit the wood siding and fell onto the concrete or the little pebbles. And didn't burn. So, personally, around my house, that's my next big thing is to clear around my buildings and lay that, 10 foot, five foot's probably in a lot of sections, just gravel so that it can't burn the ground.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, that sounds ideal. And then when you integrate animals into it, grazing animals, browsing animals, those that will help maintain for the long term to continue that work. In my situation, I have 10 pigs, American guinea hogs, and they're it's a heritage breed, I think, known in the southeast of the states, and I use them and I move them around. They're super active, and they first and foremost want to go for the leafy stuff, the poison oak and the other broadleaf and grasses, and then they go for the acorns and the bay nuts. But while they're doing that, they're using their bodies to get to these little gems, and they break down the brushy debris, the stuff that would otherwise take me time to drag out of there. and turn it into soil. You know, it's pretty incredible the work that these 10 pigs do. And I move them maybe half acre at a time with electric fencing, solar powered, and they respect it and it works well. And they don't take a break, just constantly working and breaking through.
You had to train them with the electric wire, yes?
Yeah, it didn't take long. It's a very simple system. Mm-hmm. And relatively inexpensive as opposed to building permanent fencing, which they'll end up breaking and getting through anyway, mm-hmm. if they mm-hmm. think there's better food on the other side of that fence. Whereas the electric fencing is lightweight, and it provides a little zap. I get shocked by it all the time. But certainly as a mammal, it doesn't feel good. So you avoid it. And as long as they have enough to browse, and even some supplemental feed, which I use to really drive them into the thickest of the stuff with this organic mm-hmm. hog grower pellet. I'll throw it in there and they go after it. They'll spend all day going after it, breaking down that woody debris into soil. It's pretty amazing. You know, other people use goats and that's a whole nother love-hate relationship that I have. I mean, I have goats at home and I use them certainly on my half acre, but you know, when you're doing that inventory, it really is, what is your goal, you know, the goal in mind and how you use your animals to help you with the fenceable space. Every animal has a niche and they'll all work totally different. And goats are a whole another world.
Right. So how many goats do you have on your half acre?
I have six. And thankfully, mm-hmm. I have a partnership. It's really a handshake agreement with my neighbor who has an 11 acre pasture. And I have them mm-hmm. out there with my hens right now when there's not enough on my little space for them to eat. But generally they are my manure makers and the receivers of everything that gets torn out of my garden gets taken care of by those guys, including our Christmas tree this year, which is pretty amazing. They turned it into toothpicks.
Why don't we do, I think it'd be fun for people to hear, first of all, an inventory of your menagerie at home, and then an inventory of mm-hmm. your menagerie over at Hansel. So why don't you give us a lay down of what you got.
Yeah, the line between my work life and my home life is very blurry. So at home, like I said, it's a half acre. We've had it for 4 years now, and I'm just starting to really understand the system of the 1916 house that's here and the grounds and all the infrastructure. The rain recently taught me a lot about this place and how the drainage and the runoff is and where I need to put sump pumps and all that, and where I need to plant different stuff to benefit from the seasonal, you know, flood water that we have here in Petaluma. But I've got six goats, a couple of turkeys, 50 hens, 50. Tortoises. Pretty fun. A whole lot of fruit trees, a big garden. The garden is really the focus. The footprint of the garden is probably bigger than my house. And then we have a beautiful corner with a heritage.
What's that size?
My house is 900 square feet.
No, I meant the garden. But so the garden's about 1,000 square feet.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I have another planting area along the southern fence line where I generally rotate it between, you know, rye and sunflowers and any other, you know, showy piece that feels good in the spring and summer that I can also.
How big is that section?
80 feet long. Yeah, mm-hmm. two big beds, and they're both 80 feet long. The garlic is going to go in any day now.
I remember in one of your Instagram postings, you collected some rye.
I did, red winter rye.
And did you grind it and make it into something, or what did you do? You did.
Yeah, I've got an old timey mill and a stone mill, yeah. And we make our own flour. It's tasty. It's so good.
That's awesome.
And I just planted one of those beds last week. So hopefully nice. we'll get another. I really love that plant. It's really beautiful and tall. So what I like about having it on the boundary of our property is the pasture that I was talking about where I have those goats grazing, sometimes we get really undesirable non-native invasive plants growing out there that the goats won't touch. And I think when I have tall stuff growing on my boundary, it prevents a lot of those seeds from coming in and across. So they just drop out.
I think our viewers and listeners might be very interested in what are the plants that the goats won't touch.
It's a mix of Euro grasses and thistle type stuff that is not palatable. Super spiky.
What do you mean a Euro grass? What is that?
European invasive grasses. So stuff that came years ago, you know, most likely on livestock in their.
Just a normal, does it look like normal grass or is it, because thistles obviously has the spikes and everything. And
exactly. I'm like I said, we've been here for 4 years. I'm still doing an inventory on what's popping up here and there, still learning. And it's a seasonal thing late in the fall. So when everything else is gone, dry, and I'll also bale back there. I'll do some grass collecting and bale that stuff up for the animals. Likewise, avoiding some of these weird stands of these awkward thistle, spiky, you know, undesirable stuff. So I try to hand harvest those and literally throw away the seed heads into the dump. Curbside. So I have half a notion of making some sort of like Ghostbusters backpack with a shop vac to like suck out all those seed heads so they don't continue. So it's just a matter of out competing those, you know, getting them before they go to flower and seed. And hopefully they won't show up the next year. So we'll see. This will be a big year to observe that.
How are you baling? Are you baling by hand or are you using machine?
A machine. So it's a work machine that thankfully I'm able to use at home. We use it at work all the time. It's called a BCS. It's a two-wheeled walk-behind tractor, and it has various implements that you can attach to it. You may have seen it when we were there together.
Are we talking about your home site now, or are we talking about hand sale now? Sorry, I got a little...
It's a blurry line between work and home for me. So it's a work tool that I borrowed for home. Yep. And,
right. Cool.
I baled grass on this 11 acre parcel so that I could feed the cows at work.
Cool. I want to see that thing in action. I want to see the laydown machine and then the baler in action so we make a video about that in the future.
Yep, I could send you that link on Instagram. It's pretty amazing the implements that this BCS has. Like one implement is the sickle bar mower for the front end, and then you swap it out for the rake, the hay rake, and that rakes it all into rows. And then the next implement is the baler itself, and it does it all. It's pretty amazing, and it's all a one person operation, by the way. So it's a walk behind. Simple, lightweight. It's fantastic. And then we use the same thing to build beds, garden beds at work. So it has a power harrow attachment, so it builds just beautiful beds. And in that regard, power harrow, it's not quite tilling, you're not going too deep, it's more like an egg beater. So it disturbs the top layer and leaving all the biology of what's going on deeper down intact. Cool. So it can keep on regenerating year after year.
Nice. So yeah. I'm not sure if we got through all your animals yet. Did we get through all your animals at home? We got through the home animals, right?
Yeah. Goats, turkeys, hens, tortoises. Yep. Yep. We sure did.
Okay. Great. And then, let's see. So now what about your herd at Hensel?
Yeah. So the reason, you know, we brought animals onto the land, it's sort of like a homecoming in a way, you know, kind of bringing back the way it was always done before humans got distracted by heavy equipment and chemicals. So we split up the team. Currently, the grazing team at Hensel is in three different parts. Like I mentioned, the pigs, they're constantly working the forest. And once in a while, I give them a break to get out in the vineyard for some nice, rich cover crop growth to eat on, very rich. We have the new element, and that is four belted Galloway Scottish cows. So I have them also working a forest slash pasture paddock right now. Also electric fencing, solar powered, very temporary and movable and easy. So that's the other team, and they're going to integrate into the vineyard soon. So once the ground gets a little bit more firm, because we had some recent rains and I think they would do more damage than good. Plus we're waiting for our cover crop to get a little taller and more lush. And then the third and the main team that we have is a multi-species team of sheep, chickens, geese, ducks, and guardian dogs. Right now, they are in the vineyard. We have them working in a hillside that hasn't been grazed in a couple of years. So we can't get to all 46 planted acres of vineyard with our small team, because it's just a lot of terrain to get through between the time we have enough cover crop for them to eat and the time that vineyards start bud break and pushing their delicate, delicate flowers for the upcoming harvest, because they would love to eat that. But if they eat that, then, well, that pays the bills.
So what do you do? So just to explain to people that your system there, you plant the cover crop grows, you bring in, does the BCS lay the stuff down too, or is that a different machine?
That's a different machine. We'll use one of our farm tractors, full-size tractors, to crimp it over. So,
crimp it. So we'll do crimp it over, and then the team comes in, right?
Well, kind of. So the crimping is one of three things we do with the cover crop. So we'll graze. The stuff we graze is completely left alone and for the animals. That's one thing, grazing with our animals. And of course they're giving along the way with their manure and urine and light disturbance.
And then just so people have a visual, they're grazing between the rows of grapes.
Yeah. We'll give them anywhere between two rows and 15 rows. And we may move them every day or every other day, depending on how long the rows are and how active, how well they're doing. We don't want to go too heavy, because we like to leave some of that cover crop to bounce back, to go to flower and drop seed. And that is probably the most beneficial for the vineyard, for sure, because of what the animals leave behind. Right. Now the second thing we do is we crimp, and we've talked about that just a touch. And so usually when the cover crop goes to flower and seed and we crimp it over, we hit a majority of the vineyards with that, because we can get most done with that crimp device. And what that looks like is a big roller drum on the back of our tractor as we pull along. And it lays down the cover crop, and by then it's about 4 or 5 feet tall. It doesn't kill the plant, but it terminates it from further growth, but allows it to go into seed mode after the flowers. And of course seeds drop in the soil, and then it provides a lovely moisture blanket for the rest of the year. So all that vegetative matter allows the soil temperature to be low and the moisture level to be high. So fingers crossed, we get that vegetation covering that soil all year long, even into fall when it's 115 degrees outside. You won't see bare mineral soil. Right. So that is awesome to see that. You can dig down in the summer and still find earthworms when that cover crop is just crimped over and covering everything. So at the same time, that crimped over cover crop will outcompete some of the other undesirable stuff like star thistle and things like that. We have very little of that, and very little need to go back and hand weed eat or hand tool some of that stuff out of the way from underneath the vines. So thankfully, so the third thing we do, and we do this, I guess the least, and that would be baling. So we'll bale the cover crop too. And if it doesn't have a lot of legume, big, moisture filled, legume plants like fava bean or bell bean in there, it will keep really well in those bales. And then we'll feed that to our animals for the rest of the year. It's a pretty intense process. And we try to vary that, all three of those things. We try to do those differently through the vineyards every year. So it's not the same every time.
Rotating the different systems through the, so that each one gets a different beneficial type of interplanting.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's all scalability, right? If it was a smaller property or we had more animals, we would graze 100% of it. And then we would let that, all that stuff rest, bounce back. And then we would crimp it all over, you know, crimp it down. Right. So we'd do both of those things. And then scalability though, you know, we bring on more animals, it's going to require more humans to manage them. So I think we're in a real sweet spot right now.
Let's try to get a little bit. So thinking about the person who's listening to this, they probably don't have a vineyard. Maybe some of them do. If you do, I'm super stoked that you're listening, and I hope you're going to incorporate some of these rad practices on your vineyard. But for a lot of us, you know, we're interested in the animal husbandry and the fire mitigation, and probably have a smaller piece of land. So maybe it would be neat to talk about. Let's say I'm just getting started, which I used to have goats and I have chickens and I have ducks, and but I'm just getting back into my own personal management program. And I know there's a lot of people out there that want to raise animals and want to raise them for food and for, you know, for a, I'm so many people may not know the term silviculture, right? Excuse me?
Or silver pasture. I've heard it both ways, but
silver pasture. Yeah. Where you utilize the animals in the forest or in the pasture, as a polyculture system where they're all working together. So I think it would be really interesting to hear, if we took sort of an example lot, let's say you have a half an acre, like you have a half an acre. So let's say you have a half an acre and you want to get started and you're super ambitious, kind of like I am. Like I've probably got I'm in a mountainous terrain. So I probably have a usable half of an acre, maybe. But I'd like to pack as many animals as in there and get as many diverse multiple relationships as I can. I get overzealous and I want to do too much. And then I have too many different balls in the air. And so trying to find that balance, like you say, the economy of scale on a smaller property, you know, and how you could best utilize for food, for fertilization, for ecological diversity and biomass enhancement and and soil enhancement. Like let's just take an example, sort of gently sloped property facing south, so we have decent sun, so we don't have to worry about shade, and build ourselves for the listeners, our beginning menagerie, polyculture menagerie. Where would you start?
I would start slow and small. I would start with observing, you know, the classic permaculture style of really soaking up a whole year of observations before you really make any big changes or big additions. I would go small because you don't want to set yourself up for failure or overwhelm, you know, so immediately. We're all impulsive and we all want it all now. That's for many reasons. Just for, you know, what is realistic and reasonable in your time, the time you have. For me, it's a work-life balance, you know, trying to find the right fit too on all these different elements and implements that I've been trying out. Starting small is a good way to set yourself up for success. Starting small with a low number of animal units, really trying to think about what your goal is. You know, what are your, identify your needs and figure out those goals. And you can start slowly that way. Every animal element will have a different need as far as water is concerned. Water is a big concern. Fencing and housing all those critters. Like at my place, I have a hard enough time separating stuff just because I don't want my goats to eat my fruit trees. I don't want my goats to end up in my garden and thrashing that. Like my hens, when I build a nice, beautiful bed, the first thing they'll want to do is get in there and start scratching away. So But there are times of the year when I want them in there eating all that stuff and really going to town on doing their beautiful niche. So really my point is small, starting small. Like I mentioned before, I have about 50 hens in my half acre and six goats. And that to me feels like a good number. I don't, there's nothing that's screaming out to me to get more, although having more eggs would be handy, you know, cause I sell, that's one of the commodities I have is I sell eggs to friends and family, and that helps support the supplemental feed. So there's another topic. What can you produce on your half acre or your size lot that will go to sustain the whole program? And what do you need to buy from somewhere outside your circle to help supplement your program? That feed cost, that water cost, that, you know, what kind of inputs do you need from outside your own hands and ability? That tends to be the decision maker on stuff.
Let's dig into that a little bit. I think that's probably one of the least talked about and most important things that, you know, homesteaders and people who want to produce their own food don't think about or aren't really addressing is this external input idea. What is the feed? What's your chicken feed and your goat feed right now? And it's, I mean, should be pretty, probably pretty straightforward, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. The more I pasture them, the more space, like I was stoked to get this partnership with my neighbor. You know, I have a half acre. My neighbor's has 11 acres and it's just undealt with grassland, mowed once a year by them and a contractor of theirs. So, thankfully he's okay with me getting out there. And so I have them out there every day, unless it's been raining a bunch, like it has been, they don't like that, but, that gives them the ability for stimuli. Like they need stimuli. They can't be in a small space or they're going to go crazy. They'll get unhealthy. Having them, I have a really good situation here with that. So they're out there browsing, they're out there finding, all kinds of good stuff. And so I supplement that with, some good, you know, organics. Thankfully there's some feed shops around here that have, like for the goats, organic alfalfa and organic three-way, which is a barley, rye, oat mix. And so I give them a couple of flakes of that every day. And they're fine. And as long as I have them out in that pasture for their physical stimuli and a little bit of forage, I'm doing an ecosystem service by maintaining that pasture mode per se. So that's doing a service there while they're finding good stuff to eat. The chickens likewise. So,
local shops have something that I think would be a good thing to interject right here. You know, most people aren't going to have, you know, the 11 acre neighbor, but everybody's got neighbors, you know. And when I was speaking in my last interview with Damian Luce from Permaculture Artisans, we were talking exactly about that, it's about developing beneficial relationships with the landscape and with each other. And so that brings up the idea that I think that most of us could really benefit from by trying to create a permaculture style beneficial relationship with our neighbors. Because if we can find mutual, like you're finding a mutually beneficial interaction with your neighbor, which is then benefiting both of you and benefiting the landscape and benefiting your flock. So, you know, even in a suburban context, it could be that, you know, you join your two backyard fences and then, you know, the chickens can go to the one that's not being utilized, or the goats can go and browse. Yeah. And that I think we often overlook that. We often think that I need everything on my own plot. If I'm going to be sort of this self-reliant permaculturist, I got to design all the systems in my little tiny space or bigger space if you're lucky. And we have to start thinking more about, like, are there people around us that we can partner with, and how can we partner with the people around us? And that's difficult because we all have different values. What's that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So while you're doing these relationship buildings and how can I benefit you and you, me, having in mind the ultimate goal of being more sustainable and more able to produce what you need on your own. You know, having both in mind, right. I think, is a good thought.
It's difficult, you know, that's why there's so much conflict in the world, to sort of find our common grounds. And your neighbors not necessarily have the same value set as you do. They might right. have some of it, but, you know, to try to find, build that bridge somehow, I think is probably as equally important as all of the stuff that we do in the landscape.
Yeah. Yep. That's right. Relationship building. Super good.
Go ahead.
I was just going to advocate for, you know, what the costs to keep your place going, you know, costs of things that you don't generate yourself, the things that you need to supplement and paying for that. I have the most janky, basic farm stand out on the road, and anything that's surplus of mine that I'm not going to eat or I'm not going to use, I put out there and it disappears. It goes away and people, you know, kick down, and it's great. And I don't have prices on anything, but it's enough to make
it. They can put money in?
Yeah. And a PayPal and a link for, you know, that kind of stuff, however digital. And it always surprises me. I don't know, surprises me. It's just so lovely to see people give for whatever or not. If they take stuff, and that's fine. But folks give, and that helps add to the program. So it all goes back, you know.
Nice.
It's pretty great.
Nice. That's awesome. I'm so happy to hear that. I'd love to see an image of your farm stand. That would be really cool.
Cool.
Do you have that somewhere?
Yeah, and it's very seasonal too. So I'll load it up with pumpkins in the fall. And right now, the thing that's going to hit the farm stand in a week or so are 100 raspberry. You know, I thin my raspberry beds, my hugel culture, and it just produces so much, so many splits from the crowns. Nice. and they could stoke out other people with the same, you know, successful fruit plant. So it's pretty incredible. Nice. They're all in 1 gallon pots, so it's really easy to stop and grab and then go.
Right. Yeah. So let's get back to our sort of imaginary half acre system that we're building here. We're starting with observing. We're, you know, going slow. We're doing small. Let's say we've been observing. We're going slow. We're doing small. We decided that we want to have, you know, 5 chickens because we need at least that much eggs. Let's just start with 5. And then let's say we decided we want to do goats too for fire mitigation. How would you... Yeah, I mean, I guess just talk about feed, water, shelter, predators, and how you would start to design and build that system.
Yeah. I would say your time minimum, you know, twice a day, feeding in the morning, just general checking on them. And in the evening, you're kind of buttoning everything up, you know, closing things as necessary, collecting eggs, general water. You know, it's always about just observing, you know, just getting a good pulse on things. So minimum twice a day. So if it's like most of us going to work, you know, it's in the morning and in the evening. You can integrate family, which is really fun, especially kids love collecting eggs. And they can be treated like pets too, you know? So it's just like your family dog or cat. It's just so fun. So minimum checking twice a day for sure. It depends on where, go ahead.
Just so in terms of the permaculture zones idea, like how far away from your home are you comfortable having your goats in your chicken pen?
Yeah, I don't mind super close, but there's a noise thing, you know, you have to be cognizant of how, you know, sleep patterns and, you know, are you going to have roosters or not? Goats could be pretty loud in the morning, especially dairy goats, which I've had before when they get used associating humans with getting fed, and then when they're hungry they bleat out very loud, especially those dairy goats who are going through a lot of calcium. So mine is a good 60 feet away from the house, you know, and that's tolerable, it seems, and that works. Then there's the manure piece. You know, if you've got enough of happening enough, you know, the compost pile and manure smell, that kind of thing. You know, you got to play around with that too, making sure that things are mucked and new, fresh straw placed down and, you know, things like that. So that doesn't become an issue. And with enough hens flicking through manure of the goats and themselves, they're going to get to all the larva. So you won't have a whole lot of bug issues if you do have a healthy system with enough hens to eat all that. So that's not a concern.
Do your goats and your chickens live in the same area, not separate?
No, turkeys and ducks as well. Yeah, they're all in the same area. They all browse.
In the hand cell, or they're the same? No, oh, I see.
Yeah, at home and at work, everybody mm-hmm. lives together for the most part. So.
And do you have protection dogs at home going on to predator?
No. I have fencing and I have electric fencing for when my goats and hens are on the neighbor's pasture, and then mm-hmm. I lock them in at night. So I physically go out and I close the gate. The hens have their own little hen door. Thankfully, I haven't had predator issues in 2 years. I had a fox hop a fence and killed a bunch of turkeys of mine, and that was the last incident. So I'm thankful of that. Raccoons have been an issue in the past, but not so much here. It all depends. So where you live, you know, what are your predators? That's part of that inventory of building relationships.
We have bobcats out here. So that's our big one, or the bobcats, which literally we know that they watch us now. They'll stand in the forest and watch us walk away.
they figure out your timing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sorry, I had another question. At night, is the goat pen chicken coop the same?
It is not. So I call it the goat run, chicken run. The goats hang out in that, whereas the chickens have their own little, it's about 12 feet by 6 feet. It's a roosting area. I'm able to harvest all their manure through the night as it drops into a space that they can't get to. So it's a whole nother topic for composting.
Is that a wire screen, like a hardware cloth, and it goes through the hardware cloth?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Cool. And they can't get to that. I wanted to go just touch back with the predator issue. The other benefit of relationship building with your neighbors is knowing what's in the neighborhood, you know, what's been lurking at their place. And when something, there's a sighting, my neighbors and I, we all send each other, those observations. If we see, a group of raccoons, or we see whatever, even deer, you know, it's just fun to have those observations. A big buck is in the backfield right now. Check it out. You know, that kind of thing. So,
wow. Cool. That's awesome. That's great. Mm. Okay. Feed.
Yeah. Likewise. Go ahead.
Feed, shelter, predators. So wait a minute. Let's talk a little bit more. So the supplemental feed for the chickens is just, I imagine it's an organic pellet. Go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. They're laying hens, so a little high in the protein. And then water is another concern too, that right in that same vein, that same chapter. All my stuff is on float valves. Thankfully, we have a well. So there's plenty of that. But it's checking that every day with these low temperature nights, you know, if there are water breaks occur. So that part of that observation is putting your eyes on all the systems and that they're making sure they're working. Because if the water's
and
out,
then are you using a trough? Then you're not using nipples for the chickens.
I want to get into that. The install of PVC and those nipples that are really cool, that I know that the chickens can flick and peck, and then they get water instantly. But then there's the goats, and the goats do kind of a slurping thing. They need a container. So I'm using a small float valve on a little corral attachment for them, but pretty clean and not a lot. Yeah.
Good. Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So the feed, I think we covered the feed. Have you ever, just out of curiosity, have you thought about insect farming? Because I've thought about it a lot for supplemental bird feed. I haven't tested that one yet, but I'm thinking about it.
Sweet. That would be cool. No, I don't know anything about it. I want to know more. So maybe you can interview somebody that's done that.
Yeah, that'd be great. That's a good idea for another episode. You know, because I'm really, you know, the idea of this whole permaculture, even biodynamic regenerative system, is we have to produce more of our own inputs. We can't be importing stuff into the landscape as much. And so it's a rabbit hole. There's so much fertility, I think, that's possible if we really put our creative mindset to it and build more ecosystems on our properties. We can generate more life, but you know, that it's a process, it's a learning curve, and does take a lot of resource and creative thought. So to be continued on that.
Right. Yeah. Work-life balance. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where are you going to apply your time? That's probably the big limiting factor in this whole thing, is just your energy. You know, at the end of the day, how much energy do you have to put back into it? How much time on your days off can you apply to improving your systems even further, doing that research, trying to experiment? It is all a big experiment, all of it.
Yeah.
Because my half acre may be totally different than yours.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Oh, because, well, you know, my half acre may be totally different than yours. And what might work for me doesn't work for you.
Right. Yeah. But I think it's such a valuable thing that you're bringing up that is just not addressed enough. And that is like, how are we going to manage our time effectively? You know, we get all these ideas about what we want to do, and more regeneration, more self-reliance, more sustainability, but then don't actually lay out the time and energy components that are necessary for our life. So I think you're just right on par with, you know, go slow and start small and take it from there. And then the other thing I really liked that you said was the systems part. I'm a huge fan and advocate of, experimenting, but also trying to create our systems that last longer, you know, that are more resilient and even redundant, you know? So, I mean, there is that maintenance component always, but you can, you know, there's a difference between, a Costco carport and then like the most resilient metal fire resistant building, you know, barn thing that you can build. And one's going to take maintenance every, you know, 5 or 2 or whatever years. And the other one's going to be fairly solid for a while. So I'm just thinking in terms of like, how can the question that comes up for me, and I'd be really curious what your thoughts are, is when is it the right time to put in the really long-term infrastructure, and when should I go with the temporary experimental one, and how do I know when to make that transition? You know, let's say in this beginning barn setup that we're setting up, like how do you even approach that?
I would not approach it alone. I think that if there are mentors out there, elders out there, contemporaries, just grab somebody and get their input, their feedback. I think that the drive is the self-sustaining thing means you got to do it all alone. I don't think that's the case at all. I think now that we're in this world of social media and digital everything, and there's so many people that are trying to do the same stuff we are, there's a good coalition of folks that can advise. You know, the mentorship thing is where it's at, I think. Thankfully, I've got that. And a lot of our efforts are collaborative at work, a lot of decision-making. As an example, today I was on and off the phone today regarding a new, brand new problem that we've got. We've got now sheep that are nibbling on our grapevines that are dormant. And even before we've prune them, and this is a new thing. Over the last 4 years, they haven't done that at all, and there's something just new about this. And so what to do about it? Myself and my team were brainstorming this morning, and I'm sure the rest of today we're going to try to figure that out, because it really changes everything for their piece. And how do we manage that? And of course, any time you spend money is an investment. And so if it's a big chunk, like you're talking about a barn, you want to make the right decision. You don't want to waste the precious resources that we have. collaborate.
Collaborate. I love it. That seems to be the theme, the thread of the what the interviews. Actually, that was a thread that came through on the interview with Damian a couple of days ago. So I think that's probably a good place to wrap up. Thanks so much for coming out and talking to us. And if you're open to it, let's do this again and find another topic that's really interesting that would be valuable to the greater community of Earth lovers that are trying to make this world a better place and make their lives more resilient and regenerative at the same time. So,
beautiful.
Do you want people to contact you, or do you want to give them
a handle? Sure, absolutely. Of course, I'd love to help anybody that's interested in this. Sharing information is my pursuit as well. So
okay, and where can they find you? You want to find? They want them Instagram or?
Yeah, Instagram's great. Brandon.Bredo, Bredo is the last name. Mm-hmm. Yep, on Instagram. Real simple there. I share stuff from work and home. You know, everything we've been talking about is all there in a visual, videos and still shots and some write ups about it all.
I love your Instagram stuff. I think everybody should be subscribed to your channel.
Nice. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, man. Likewise.
Yeah. Well, cool. Great. And thanks again. And we will talk again soon.
Perfect.